So this guy here, that is, I think all pastors should pose like this for pictures. I had another one. It was of him having a cigarette, and I was like, oh, the Fabio picture or the cigarette picture, which one? He's a German. His name is Dietrich Bonhoeffer. He was influential in the 1930s in Germany. He was part of what's known today as the Confessing Church. They were the church that stood up to the Nazis and didn't believe what the Nazis believed and didn't cave to the Nazi regime like the state churches did. And so much of his pastoral ministry was spent underground in hidden away places. And so he actually taught at a seminary for several years that was basically a secret seminary. His most famous book is a book called The Cost of Discipleship. His second famous book probably is this one called Life Together, in which he talks about what it means to live in Christian community. In this, when we think going to school or going to seminary, you have to kind of put away what you think of. These guys would have lived together, ate together, studied together. That's what it would have looked like for them. And so Bonhoeffer led them. Eventually, Bonhoeffer ended up fleeing to England for a time, and then he felt like God was calling him to go back, and he was arrested by the Nazis for being part of a conspiracy to try to blow up Hitler. And then he was eventually killed by the Nazis. He says this in his book, Life Together, and I want to raise these two things, and just I want you to react to these two statements. Let him who cannot be alone beware of community. Let him who cannot be alone beware of community. And on the flip side, let him who is not in community beware of being alone. What do you hear in that? What do you think Bonhoeffer is after? What's he trying to say? How does that resonate with you? Yeah, or not? I don't like the language of before, but at least equal. Like both of those things need to be running on parallel tracks. Let's say it that way. I didn't do this first service. I'm just curious. How many of you, the idea of being in community with a bunch of people sounds really, really appealing most of the time? And how many of you find being alone very, very appealing most of the time? All right? How many of you raised your hand both times? You can't be both all the time. You want to be alone by yourself, surrounded by people, right? The person in the coffee shop with the headphones in, where they're actually on and you're not just using it as an excuse to eavesdrop. I'm that guy. Okay, very good. What Bonhoeffer's after then is he says this, only in fellowship do we learn to be rightly alone. And only in aloneness do we learn to live rightly in the fellowship. What Bonhoeffer understood in living in this context, Nazi Germany with young pastors, is that there needed to be in our lives this space where we were by ourselves before God, but there also needs to be space where we are with others before God, that there's this back and forth that needs to happen, because it's in the being alone that I wrestle with God and I understand my need for community, and it's in when I'm in the community that I recognize how much more I need God. And so this morning, we're going to be talking about what it means to be in community. We're going to set aside the other one for now and talk about what it means to be in community, because what we've been doing for the last couple weeks is working through our five directives. Over Lent, leading up to Easter, we celebrated our five-year history as a church, and we thought that it was too busy then, but I thought I'd come back after Easter then and spend a couple weeks talking about what drives us as a church. Why do we do the things we do? Why are we who we are? And so we're just exploring those this morning, and I want to remind you, if you're new with us this morning, I just want to say this very clearly. We don't think of ourselves in any of these five things as arrived by any stretch, but in a conversation about what it means in this case to be in community. And last week, if you were here, you heard Jeff talk about what it means to be in process, and it was awesome and thought-provoking, and that's what I'm hoping to do as well as what he did last week, is to talk about what it means to be in community and maybe provoke some thoughts and lead you to think about some things. So here's the statement that we have. Here's where we're going to start. We believe, this is the directive, we believe that spiritual formation happens in the context of intentional relationships that may take many forms. If you've been around here for any period of time, you've probably heard this, you've seen it on our website, I've probably pulled it up in a message at some point or another. Tell me what strikes you in this. How did you, maybe when you first came here, how did you hear this? What seemed to be the important key phrases to you? Reflect on it for me. Making an effort. Good. So yeah, so part of that many forms, I was just thinking, and the picture of like, there may be people in this church that are very close, like spiritually, this is the most significant person that's ever been in my life spiritually. on the other end of the spectrum, being part of this community, we did a funeral here a couple weeks ago, and I know that there was lots of you that sat in the seats and made food for somebody you really didn't even know, and you didn't know the family, but you felt like being part of this community meant that you show up. Even if you don't know the person, the mere fact of you showing up was important to a family. And by the way, it was important to a family. And so the whole spectrum of that. Yeah, good. Anybody else? Yes, yes. I'm going to come back to that. I'm going to leave that lie, but I'm going to come back to that very idea. All right. Nobody else? Let's move on. Well, what we're going to do this morning is basically three sections. We're going to talk about definitions. We're going to work through that, what I just said. Then we're going to say some things about God, and then come back and say some things about us, and then eventually get to communion to wrap us up this morning. And I went like 15 minutes over first service, so I'm going to go fast, all right? So, definition, spiritual formation. So I had somebody tell me just recently, oh, spiritual formation, that's the new Christian buzzword. It's the same thing as discipleship. I don't care what words you use. What we're talking about, we'll get to in just a second. The reality, though, is each of us is being formed into something. We're becoming something. You're either becoming a better husband and a better father, or you're not. You're either becoming, by the choices that you make, healthier, or you're becoming less healthy by the choices you make. You're becoming something. You're becoming a better worker, a better friend, all those things. We're becoming something. And we often think, well, I'm not working at that. Well, then you're probably getting worse, and especially when it comes to relationships. So maybe there's some level in other areas of our life where you just maintain a level of fitness, that there's a maintenance to it. But in relationships, it's typically so that we're even moving closer or we're moving further away. To not tend to the relationship is to move away, because life happens and things change. And you can have, I was just this week, I was with some friends this past weekend and remarking on how much of our life changes. I'd see these people every 3 months. How much in my life changed in 3 months? Like, big stuff happened in my life and things. And so if you're not tending to a relationship, things change, people change. I don't know if you've ever had that experience where somebody you knew back in college, and then a couple years later you get together and it's like, wow, you're not, for good or bad, you're just not the same person you were back then. You're somebody totally different. When it comes to spirituality, when it comes to being formed into the image of God, we are all being formed one way or another. We're either being formed into the image of God or we're not. We're either on a spiritual journey or we're not on that journey. There's no two ways about it. You don't dip your toe in it like, I'm kind of on the thing. No, you're either on it or you're really just not. And so what we're talking about when we talk about spiritual formation, we'll get to the idea of intentional, but we're talking about being on a journey. And the definition I like to use, and I've put this up here in the past, comes from a guy named Robert Mulholland. He was a professor of New Testament at Asbury Seminary and now is pastoring a small church in Maine in his retirement years, and I got to sit under his teaching last week. And his definition of formation is this: it's a process. So it's not an accomplishment. You don't get there. It's a process. Sometimes it's a one step forward, two steps back. Sometimes you start and stop, and sometimes there's real rapid movement, and other times it's a slow, painful process. But it's a process of being conformed to the image of Christ, being like Jesus. And then what his definition does that so many other definitions in the church don't do is that it's for the sake of others. That what happens in me, the process of being formed into the image of God, is not so that I can look at myself in my spiritual mirror, because every pastor has a spiritual mirror in his office, and look at myself and say, oh, look how spiritual I am. What a great Christian I am. I'm awesome. That's not the goal. The goal of this is that because I'm being formed into the image of God, I'm a better husband. And I'm a better father, and I'm a better friend, and I'm a better pastor, and I'm a better neighbor, I'm a better baseball coach to the kids I coach in baseball. That what happens in me is for the good of other people. And so that's what we're talking about, is being formed into the image of Christ for the sake of others. So we believe that that's what spiritual formation is. We're saying that happens in the context of intentional relationships. I want you, for just a minute, if you have a pen and paper, get it out real quick. We're going to do a quick exercise. If you don't, you can maybe do this in your head. I want you to think about all the places where you sit in community. The most obvious being right here as you're sitting in community. You're sitting in a room with people, all right? But go through it. Think about work. Like, there's probably some people maybe that sit around you. You're in a community with them. There might be people that you have a smoke break with. You have a community with them. There might be people that you go out for drinks after work on Friday nights. Like, you have a community with them. You might be on a subcommittee, a team, a thing here. You might be in a team of professionals in your profession, but not at your company. You sit in that community. Maybe there's places in your, like, your physical community. So for me, like, I coach a baseball team of 9 and 10-year-old boys. I'm in a community there, and I'm in a community with their parents. And there's a couple families who have kids on both that team and my younger son's team. So we will spend 4 nights a week all summer with the same people. We're in community with them, right? We'll see them. We'll share life for the next 6 or 8 weeks. We'll be sharing our lives together because we'll be together a lot, all right? And theoretically, it's going to get warm sometime this year, and it'll be hot and sweaty, and we'll do that together too. Now, think about all those spheres of community, and then think about your family. Maybe it's just you and your spouse, but you're a community, or maybe it's then the kids, you're a community, and then the extended family, and all those things, all these places. And we could have a contest, but let's not, of who has the most communities, but we all have lots of them, right? Lots of different circles and places we sit in community. Now, I want to ask you this question. Take that list and note, like, put a star next to you. How many of those are intentional? So, like, the baseball parents we show up with, it's not really intentional. We just show up together. That's all there is to it, all right? I went to a party yesterday. It was just showing up. There's no, like, real intention to it. It's just hanging out, right? We have a lot of those. But how many of those have, like, intention behind them? For example, I've shared with you all, I'm a part of a cooking club. We have intention. The intention is that when we get together, we're going to cook. That's cooking club, all right? So there's an intention behind it. So how many of your communities have intention behind them? And then the big question, what we're interested in as a church, is how many of the communities I've set, or the communities that we have in this church, how are those intentional towards formation? In what communities do I sit in where the intent is that because I've been with these people, I will be formed in the image of Christ. Because I've been with these people, they will ask me questions that will cause me to reflect, that will maybe even drive me into my aloneness and make me ask about myself, wow, what about this and this and this and this? What kinds of relationships have that intentionality behind them? And what we're trying to do as a church, yes, we do some groups that are just about hanging out, but the real hope of the church, what the church is about, what we want to be about, is that because of the relationships, they're intentional, they're designed, and they're built around the idea of we are forming each other in the image of Christ. Does that make sense? All right? Distinguish it from some other things. So in these intentional formation communities, we ask questions like this. Am I becoming more loving? Am I becoming more kind? Am I becoming more compassionate, more patient, more forgiving? What's interesting about all those questions is, you know, that's not rocket science. I didn't make those words up or those questions up. But you can't answer any of those questions by yourself. Or you can, but you win, right? Am I being more loving? Yeah. When I look myself in the mirror and think about me, yeah, I'm becoming all those things all the time. And then I'm with the community. I'm with people. And then I recognize in myself the places where, oh, I am not loving. I am judgmental. I am condescending. I'm rude. I realize the places I don't forgive or I'm not compassionate. You know, does that make sense? It requires Christian formation, requires a community, because without the community, I will convince myself that I'm awesome. There's a story I love. One evening, a young man returning home after a long and tiring day at work gets a call from his concerned wife. Dear, be careful on the way home, as I just heard on the radio that some crazy guy has been spotted going full speed up the wrong way of the highway. Sorry, honey, don't have time to talk. There isn't one nutter, there are 1,000 of them. That's what I think about it, right? So that's why I need the community. Because without all those other cars on the road coming at me, I can convince myself that I'm driving the right way. And I need the community. We all need the community to be, in some ways, the mirror by which we go, I'm that one. And I think this is where Bonhoeffer's at in this distinction between being alone. When I'm alone with myself, then I go into community and I recognize the places where I'm still so broken and so not formed in the image of Christ, and that drives me back to that place of being alone with God. And there's that beautiful cycle then that goes between the two. And what Bonhoeffer would say is there's that ebb and flow between the two, between being alone and being with. Being alone and being with. The last word here is we say that we want that to happen then, and it may take many forms. I want to do a real quick thing, and I just need you all to pop off real fast, all right? So this is it. I want to ask you this. Tell me, don't tell me the details or the person, but or the person's name, but tell me about the communities where you've been formed in this way by somebody. So for example, and maybe not, let's just take it out of the spiritual realm. Let's just take it to you've been shaped in any way by someone. So for example, I would say when I started riding my bike, not when I was a little kid, but when I started like road biking and I got into it, I think I've shared with you all, like I would go out riding with Robert and I would follow Robert. When Robert switches gears, I switch gears. When Robert takes a drink, I take a drink because he's leading me in this and I'm following. He knows what he's doing. I do not. When I get a flat, I say, Robert, will you change it for me, please? Everything I do, he's the one who's wise and experienced. I'm the Padawan, right? That's the nature of the relationship. Tell me about the relationships you've had. How have these happened? Tell me, like, how many people, ages, kind of the dynamics, length of time you met. Give me some details about how this has happened in your life. How have you been formed by other people? Summer camp. What did that look like? Dynamics. So an older counselor? Yeah, so he was older and wiser, more experienced, and taught you in a group, okay? And then the group taught each other. Good. How else does this happen? Other forms. A student-teacher relationship. So yeah, one on as small as 8 or 10, maybe as big as a whole classroom, but yeah, one on a bunch. Awesome. You hit on something really good. She's talking about big brother, big sister, but learning from your little sister. We had somebody in the first service. He's a professor. And he talked about how students come to him. And so there's that dynamic. But then also when you're in that position, how much you're enriched as the teacher. So as I sit and people come to me, I often feel like, wow, I get the benefit of learning through you or learning by you or you ask good questions. I tell people like, this is why I love having an intern at the church because he asks good questions and he makes me, oh, well, here's why we do that. And then he leaves, and I think, well, that's a stupid reason. Like, we got to think of something better next time. You know, I mean, it's good for me. I grow equally in the process. So even though I'm older than him and have more experience than him, I learn something from him as well. What are the dynamics? The community at Cornerstone for you. So one and a bunch, but peers together, an individual. And in that, we'd probably break that down into little settings of peer, but peer-to-peer. Oh, and led. And but something very short versus some relationships are long and ongoing, very short, very intense. Anything else? Yeah. Okay. Equals. Peers. Five or six of you? Okay. Good. What we're after and what I'm trying to illustrate here is that oftentimes churches break out a new strategy, right? Because we're trying to figure out how to make this work, and I'll talk about this in a minute, how hard this is. But we break out a new strategy and say, okay, now everybody in the church is going to be in a small group, and everybody is going to meet with this small group on this night of the week, and you're going to do this book, and you're going to have this leader, and it's going to work for everybody because everybody loves small groups, except for all the people that are like, I hate that, and I don't have time for that. And what we're trying to say here and what we're trying to acknowledge is that it takes a lot of different ways. This happens in 1,000 different ways. Sometimes it's one-on-one. Sometimes it's with somebody that's my peer. Sometimes it's somebody that's more experienced and knows a whole lot more than me. Sometimes it's in a group. Sometimes that group is peers. Sometimes I'm leading that group. Sometimes I'm sitting in that group and I'm following. Sometimes it's like this, where it's me and I'm teaching you all. And sometimes on a Sunday morning even, we teach each other. And so this happens, this intentional relationships happens in a lot of different ways. Sometimes it's really short and really intense. And sometimes these relationships can last a lifetime of building into each other. So that's what we're trying to get through, that one size doesn't fit all when it comes to this kind of thing. So for a couple minutes, I want to talk about Jesus. If you have your Bible, let's turn to John chapter 17. When I've talked about community in the past, I think we've talked about this passage, but I want to read it and I want to unpack it a little bit more this morning. It's a good one to keep coming back to. It doesn't hurt. John chapter 17, if you're using a Pew Bible, page 878. Jesus here is praying you can see the headline there. Jesus prays for all the believers. This is Jesus' final prayer that we have recorded here in John's gospel before he's obviously then later down here, he's arrested. So he says this. He's praying for his disciples, and then he gets to this in verse 20. My prayer is not for them alone. I pray also for those who will believe in me through their message. That's him praying down through the corridors of time. For everybody who will believe what the disciples say, all of us. So he's praying for us. That all of them may be one, Father, just as you are in me and I am in you, may they also be in us, so that the world may believe that you have sent me. I have given them the glory that you gave me, that they may be one as we are one, I in them and you in me, so that they may be brought to complete unity. Then the world will know that you sent me, and I have loved them even as you have loved me. Now, I know just reading through this, if you've never read this before, this sounds a lot like the stuff you read at a wedding, and everybody goes, what'd he just say? That was really pretty. I have no idea what that just said, right? Loving and sharing and caring and loving. You know, like, that's what it feels like, all right? So let's unpack that. What's in there? Yeah, so this, like, the Father and I are one. This is where we get the Trinity, idea of Trinity, that God the Father, God the Spirit, God the Son live in community. And if you were in my Sunday school class, we talked about the Nicene Creed and how they developed that idea. And so Jesus saying, what we have, I want them to have. That's a high standard of community, all right? Three in oneness. What else? Yes. Their community drew people in, but then somehow we went from 12 people to thousands of denominations, right? Somewhere along the line, several places. Again, a little promo for my Sunday school class. We talked about the Great Schism this morning, and if that excites you, you'd want to come to my Sunday school class, and most of you, your eyes glaze over, so that's fine, because we talked about Charlemagne and the Great Schism this morning, and how the church keeps fracturing and keeps moving away. Yeah. Yeah, so there's something about as the church grows, the relationships still stay close as it goes out. And I'm going to come back to that because that gets really complicated fast. Yeah. Inclusion. Yeah, good. Yes. Yes, I was going to try to diagram this whole little thing here. I couldn't think of how this diagram works. Like there's one circle inside of another circle that's actually inside that circle that is really around that circle. It's really hard to keep, like, the language even betrays us of what this looks like, and it's very mystical and very Eastern Orthodox. Again, plug for Sunday school class. Here's my question about this passage. Does Jesus' evangelistic, going back to last week, Jesus' evangelistic strategy in the world, all right, options. Build more buildings, bigger churches, evangelistic plans, good-looking pastors, good-looking first ladies, if you come from that tradition. What's Jesus' plan that the whole world will know him? What's going to happen that everybody will know Jesus? What does he say? That we reflect the oneness of God. So real quick, I'm not going to tell you what the first service says. I'll let you have your own answer. How is the American church doing in this? I sense a very sarcastic thumbs up from the back. Am I reading the body language right? Like they answered much faster, much less discerning than you all, and they said, we stink, all right? It's hard. It's hard for me as a pastor to read this passage and talk about what Jesus believed would be his evangelistic strategy in the church and come to terms with the idea that I've been in ministry almost 14 years full time, and I can't remember that I've ever sat in a meeting where the purpose of the meeting was to talk about how do we be united in each other and reflect the unity of God so that people will come to know Jesus. I've sat in lots of meetings talking about how do we do the right kind of music and the right kind of preaching and the right kind of building and the right kind of style of service and the right kind of strategies to get people to know Jesus. If we just build a huge cross next to the interstate, that will get them. If I put a bumper sticker on my car, done. We spend a lot of time and energy talking about all those things, and yet Jesus doesn't seem to care whether we put bumper stickers on our car or build a building or build a huge cross next to the interstate. None of that seems to be as important, at least as important as to Jesus, the unity of the body of Christ. That this idea of being formed in community seems to be the most important thing for reflecting God to our culture. Is that fair? And so as we talk about community in our church, no pressure. But how we do community will reflect the nature of God. That's what Jesus' expectation is of our community. In fact, I think that for Jesus, this idea of community is pretty, we think of it in terms of us and then the community and that kind of thing. I'm not sure Jesus was always thinking that way. In fact, when the disciples come to Jesus and say, teach us how to pray, Jesus says, well, when you pray, pray like this. And he said what? Our Father. Not my Father, not your Father, but all of us, ours. The first word we're supposed to pray when we pray to God is us. As we become before God. We don't think in those terms very often, and yet if we're going to live like this, if the model is how the Trinity relates, it requires us, and especially hard for us rugged American individualists, to let go of some of the I and start adopting more of the we language as we come to God, as we are shaped by God. So we believe then that spiritual formation, because of what's rooted in the character of God, but we believe that spiritual formation happens in intentional relationships that take a lot of forms. About us. This is me, all right? I'm a dot, all right? Just for this. And this is my wife, much prettier dot than mine, and we got hitched a while ago. And fast forward our story, and we started making friends, and we were part of a small group that formed, and this is all the people in the small group that formed. And then they all got busy. And then, I don't know if that's actually the right number, but there's a lot of small dots, as you've all seen between services. And I don't know how many dots that is. I think that's somewhere around, I can't remember. It's a lot of dots. So take this out of me and just start thinking about if this is anybody. Well, each one of those circles is in some relationship with the other circles, right? And so I'm going to draw this in a much simplified way, all right? But pretend that just treat everybody as a couple to keep it simple, all right? And it won't be simple in a minute. But keep it simple and just treat every relationship as a couple. That's seven relationships that I need to be attending to, giving time to, energy to, thought to, give them a call, send them an email, like something. Seven relationships. That's simplified because really it's 14. We all understand that. There really should be 14 lines there. I just got tired of making lines, all right? There should be 14. And I didn't talk about all the connections between my spouse and I and my children and I and all those things as well, right? But then you get a group of people together, and it's not as much as I like to think that the world is a movie starring me. It's not. And those people all have relationships with each other, and so it gets a bit more complicated, doesn't it? The relational connectivity there gets a lot more complicated. All those things, all those lines, and I don't know how many lines there are in there, each need time and energy and maintenance and energy. And then you step into a bigger setting like a church, and there's other groups that have the same kinds of things, right? Similar relationships. And then people are never as neat and tidy as a diagram. So then there's relationships across, and some people are. And if I really want to do this chart well, I know there's probably a way to do this, you nerds, and you'll figure it out the rest of the service. But what I really wanted is these dots to be moving the whole time because things are always moving. And I wanted some of the lines to be getting darker and lighter because that's what happens in real relationships, as you draw close and then you drift apart and then you draw close and then you drift apart. and then some lines just go out for a while, and some dots decide to leave the page for a while, and then they come back, and it gets really complicated, and then there's people on the outside that come into this, and I'm still trying to keep it simple, but does it feel simple at all? And then you take this, and this is not even a fraction of the number of people we even have in this room. And then on top of all this, on top of all those relationships, then you come in and then you have somebody who has a bad relationship with one of those dots. And I wish I had this in like a dynamic graphic where you could just see the ripple effects where that happens and now it scatters this thing and this thing, because when those people are together, that person's not welcome, or it's awkward and it's strange and you can't sit down and do that. And the relationship dynamics. So then you come in new. And I think in our early days as a church, we may have done this one Sunday where we took yarn. And does anybody remember this back in the Gateway building where we took yarn and we just started throwing it across the room to each other, and we created this in yarn across the room, which takes a long time, and it just takes a long time, and it's a huge mess when we're done. But then you're a new person and you step into this, and it's really hard. How do you even begin to crack that? How do you get in? I think, if I understand psychologists right, and if I remember right, they say that each of us has, like, let's say 10 or 12 connectors. 10 or 12 relationships that we can really manage well. Well, I know for me, I've got 5 that are always accounted for. 5. Done. I've got a wife and 4 kids. They get 5 of my 10 to 12 connectors. That doesn't leave me a lot. And that's overwhelming. When you start thinking, if you could just hover above this room for a minute and just start drawing in, pretend we took this and then laid it on this room. And all the connections and all the places and all this stuff. Here's why I'm saying all this. Community is probably the hardest thing that I've worked with when it comes to leading a church. In my 14 years, I've probably spent more meetings banging heads against the wall, trying to figure out how do you help people get in community? How do you help them feel like they are us without trying to rip apart what already exists and say to people, because we all have limits, right? Does everybody have limits, or am I just the only one? Like, some of us, you heard 10 or 12 significant relationships, and you're like, are you kidding? I can barely manage 2. And personality-wise, some of us can do a little bit more, some of us can do a little bit less. But community is really, really hard. And especially if you have a mentality that it takes affinity to do formation in community. So I want to draw a distinction here for just a minute. Community is great. I love the communities I'm a part of. I love the places where I like to be with people. I like my cooking club. I like coaching baseball most of the time. For about 57 minutes of baseball practice, I love it. Then I'm ready to go home, all right? And then I just make them run. It's so much fun. Can I just say how fun it is just to make kids run, all right? This PE teachers, that's the best. I'm stressed. Run. That has nothing to do with anything. We have this idea sometimes in churches that in order to be in groups, I have to like everybody. And I like to like people. I like to be in groups with people who like me. But in order to do formation in community, we don't have to like each other. I've told you all that every quarter I go on a retreat. And so I go on this retreat, and 2 years ago, I was assigned to a small group. I'm the youngest person in the small group by 15 years at least. They all have grandchildren, all right? And I hope I'm at least 15 years from grandchildren, all right? So they're not a group of people necessarily that I would have sought out. They're just not. And in fact, when we're not meeting as a group and I'm there with our bigger group, which is about 70 of us, I don't generally talk to the other 4 people all that much. We just aren't in the same circles. We're just not. They're great people. Just not. And yet, every quarter we come together and we sit in a circle, the 5 of us, and we light a candle in the middle of the circle to remind us that we're brothers and sisters in Christ. And that the Holy Spirit, from the scripture that Seth read us this morning, the Holy Spirit is in our midst. That Jesus is in our midst. And so when they share things with me and share big stuff, because we've taken a vow of secrecy. I won't even share their first names with you. I won't share anything because I protect these people and they protect me. And so we share everything, and it's kind of a safe thing because they don't see me again for 3 months, and so I'll tell them everything. But I also know that when they hear me, the phrase we use is, I look at you, or I look at Jesus, the candle, and I look at you, and I look back at Jesus. Because what we're doing in this community is listening for each other and trying to ask each other the good questions, the questions we feel like God is wanting us to ask of each other. And it doesn't take liking each other or being best pals to do this. It doesn't take, I don't have to like everybody in a Sunday school class in here in our church to have a great discussion about the topic. I don't have to like people to go sit and do lectio with people. That's not a requirement. Now, don't hear me wrong on this. I like people, all right? I like to be liked by people, and I like to sit in circles of people that I like. That's important too, but that's not a limiter to what can be done in formation. Is that clear? It doesn't have to be that way. And sometimes you get this magical moment where the two overlap, where I genuinely like the people. I think you've talked about Cornerstone like that. Like, I like these people, and spiritual formation was happening. But it doesn't have to be that way. Okay? A couple of thoughts, and then we're going to wrap up. Formation requires honesty and humility. This sounds like, well, duh. But we're tempted in churches especially to make ourselves look as good as possible. We're tempted in our world all the time. Facebook, I mean, come on. Like, this is about image management, making myself look as good as possible. And so we're tempted when we sit in these kinds of circles to tell stories about how good I am, right? I know I've told you all this before, but I was taught in seminary that when I'm the pastor, I kind of am right now. But when I'm up here telling stories about me, what I'm supposed to do is pick stories of struggles I had in the past, but make sure that I've had some resolution over that so I can stand in front of you all and say to you all, I used to struggle with that, but now I'm victorious. I was taught that you make sure that the people always know that you got victory over this thing back there because you don't want to open up your wounds in front of people and admit where you've got it all screwed up. Don't do that because then they might be like, oh no, if the pastor's screwed up, what hope do I have? I'm screwed up, sorry. If that's what you think, you're in trouble, all right? Real community is going to require us to be honest and humble. A friend handed me this book and I've been reading through it called Carry On Warrior. And this woman writes a blog, it's called The Momastery. I obviously don't read it. Momastery. And so it's funny though, I keep reading stuff to my wife and she's like, oh yeah, I read that online. Oh yeah, I read that on her blog. I was like, well, apparently, whatever. She, very long story, very, very short. She, in her early 20s, was an alcoholic, a drug addict, just living a mess of a life, bulimic and a whole mess of things. And really just hit bottom. And if you want it, you can read it and hear her story, but she just hit bottom. And she talks about, you know, the journey of kind of crawling out of that hole and where her life is today, and it's really inspiring. And she talks about, I think the opening chapter of the book, how she was sitting in the playground one day talking to another mom, and they were doing that normal thing that we all do where we talk at the surface, like, how is it? How are the Cubs? Bad as usual. Why are you asking? When's football start? You know, like that kind of thing where we just keep it at the surface. How are you doing? Good. Busy? Yeah, I'm busy. Doing baseball with the kids. The thing that we should do, all right? I'm not putting that down. We have to do that. But she was sitting next to this mom one day and she said, you know, I'm just tired of doing that. And so I just told her, here's where I'm at, and just let it go. And she said the other mom just kind of, they just connected. And she didn't say it exactly this way, but this is what she was saying. We compete over our strengths. We connect in our weaknesses. We compete over strengths. This is what I did. I bench lift this. Bench lifted. Picked up the big weights. This is how many I did. I mean, just the gym is a great place, right? It's so much fun to watch the people watching themselves in the mirror. Like, just the contest. You know this, right? Like, yeah, like, and we compete over our strengths. You know, like, I've always said, like, if guys had babies, there would be, like, big contests. Like, huh, I push out a 19.4. No, I'm in 914. Whoa. guys would brag. We get tattoos with stats like, these are the size kids I had, because we compete over our strengths. But we connect to people in our weaknesses. We find deep, meaningful connections when we can say to somebody, this is where I'm broken, and somebody else says, me too. Yep, I know that feeling. Or even if they can't say me too, to be that space where they remind me that I'm loved by God. When I feel the most shame and the most brokenness and the most like I should have been so much further by now, to find those people who say, don't forget that you're still God's beloved. You're still loved more than you can possibly imagine. It's in our weaknesses that we connect to each other. It's in our brokenness that we really bond. And so this kind of community, oh, I think it only starts when people, what's the line from the real world when people stop being what and start being real, whatever the line is. Like, but that's it. When we start being real and start naming, this is what I really am. I'm sorry, I'm quoting the real world in the middle of church, all right? Two more things real fast, and then we'll get to communion. I want to be clear, this isn't about giving advice. I tell people all the time when you come to me, if you came to me in my office and said, you know, I'm going through this life thing and I need some advice, I tell people right up front these days that my job as a pastor is not to give you advice. My job is to help you find God in the middle of that. Whether it's your crisis or it's your celebration or it's a big decision you're making or if it's your marriage is a mess, my job isn't to fix you. My job is to help you find what God is saying in you. And I think that's not just true of the pastor. I think that's true of spiritual communities as well. It's not our job. We can't make decisions for each other. One of the rules that we're taught when I sit with that group on my retreats is that it is not my job to discern what God is saying to somebody else. All I can do is reflect what I know. Hey, I feel like God is saying this to you. And if that's garbage to you, spit it out, all right? Because I'm just saying what I hear. That's all I can do. You have to find what God is saying to you. I can't make a decision for you. I can't help you choose it. I can't choose your career or choose your job path or choose what choices you're going to make in your marriage. All I can do is help you find, maybe help listen with you for what is the Spirit saying in this moment. This is not about finding places to get advice. We are an advice-loving culture, right? I think afternoon TV is just advice giving. You go from Dr. Oz, who gives you a bunch of health advice, to Dr. Phil, who gives you all kinds of advice of some sort. We just get advice, 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 advice. There's an advice column in the paper every day that I can't stop myself from reading because it usually makes me mad or laugh or both. And this isn't about advice giving. It's about helping each other find God. And then real quick note, and I told Lesser service, I could spend a whole day on this. But during Lent, John Bussone was teaching on idolatry, and he was teaching on Wednesday night, so he didn't have as much time, and I've been thinking about idolatry, and idolatry is anything we put in the space between God and I, anything that we think will meet our needs. And so I say that, and probably most of us don't have idols that we worship in our homes. We probably don't do that, but we're all, you know, smart people, and so we can extrapolate. We understand that, oh, so a car can be an idol, because if I just buy that car, then I'll be happy. If I just buy that house, I'll be happy. If I just get that thing, that whatever. We all, I think, know that pretty well, too. We get there, we're like, oh, yeah, well, we see how our stuff can be an idol. But in the same way, community can become an idol in the church. As much as you heard me say everything else, all right? When we approach community or marriage or a friendship or anything else with the idea that this person or these people will fulfill the deepest needs in me, that is an idol. And some of us can come into these kind of communities, and Bonhoeffer talks a lot about the people that have bad views of this stuff and can skew a community. If I come to it and expecting that it will fulfill needs in me, that it's not there to fulfill. And so this is just, I just want to put this up as a warning to say, be careful. Especially in our churches today, we talk so much and we sell, I'm guilty. I've stood up before churches and sold community as the thing that will fix everything. And it's not that, it's peace. And so two people can join a community and they can do it for different reasons. Just like two people can go out and buy a Honda Accord, and one does it because it's a right, good financial decision for them, and one can go buy the same car because it's a status symbol. For one, it's an idol. For one, it's just a car. Right? You follow that? One person can join a community because that's where they're finding God, and that's how they're being formed in the image of God. And another person can join a community because they think it's going to fulfill all their junk. And it's not going to do that. I want to finish this morning I'm going to go back and I'm going to read the John 17 passage, and I'm going to ask you in just a second to close your eyes, and I'm just going to read it. And really, I don't have a big thing here at the end to say this is what we need to do, but just to invite you into this conversation about community. One of the big deals for us as a church right now is that in a couple weeks, we're going to bring in somebody that we're thinking about hiring, and we're hoping that he's going to lead us into new ways and new practices of community. And not that we think it's a one-size-fits-all. We don't want one-size-fits-all, but that will give us new venues, new places, like we do Suppers for Six and Sunday School classes and some of those things that will give us other ideas for how to do that, how to take that question mark on the outside and move them into community. Because that's, I don't have, if you want to come up and talk about that afterwards, I'll just tell you up front, I have no answers. So it's a lot of head scratching and things I've tried, and some have worked better than others. Nothing's been perfect. And so really the only invitation is that start thinking and start processing, and maybe for some of us to start reaching out and to start opening space for community. I'm going to read the John 17 prayer again and then lead us right into prayer. And then after that, we're going to move into community, into communion. And if you're new with us, I just want to tell you, we usually read the Apostles' Creed. We're not going to do that this morning. We're just going to move straight to it. But you're welcome to take communion with us. If you can say the Apostles' Creed, if you believe that, you're welcome to take communion with us as brothers and sisters. And just logistics, that side is wine and this side is grape juice. And if you have gluten things, there's a gluten-free station over here at the piano. You can or the piano bench down here. You can come over there and get that. And so we welcome you to come take communion, and then I'll come and dismiss us after communion's over. Will you bow your heads, and then I'll read this, and then I'll pray. My prayer is not for them alone. I pray also for those who will believe me through their message, that all of them may be one, Father, just as you are in me and I am in you. May they also be in us so that the world may believe that you have sent me. I have given them the glory that you gave me, that they may be one as we are one. I in them and you in me, so that they may be brought to complete unity. Then the world will know that you sent me and have loved them even as you have loved me.